Welcome back to the Operational Arch. In this episode, we continue to explore the topic of Napoleon as a historical figure, as well as our thoughts on the upcoming movie. If you have not listened to episode 18, we encourage you to do so before listening to this one. In that episode, we discuss Napoleon as a historic figure, his influences, and campaigns. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Can you imagine being Napoleon, or better yet, being one of his soldiers, saying something like 40 centuries look down upon you?
Hello, welcome to the Operational Arch, bridging the gap between strategy and tactics and the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. I'm Lieutenant Colonel J.D. Corliss alongside Major Brian Lander. With us today is Dr. Jonathan Abel, an associate professor at U.S. Army's Command and General Staff College. Dr. Abel received his undergraduate degree from Midwestern State University and received his Ph.D. from the Military History Center at the University of North Texas. He is an award-winning author and has a number of publications to his credit, in particular a series titled History Versus Hollywood. As a professor at CGSC, he has helped shape field grade officers for years in the Department of Military History and as the chair of the MMAS program. When not educating Army officers in French, Greek, and Roman military history, you can find him on the podcast, A Confused Heap of Facts.
Sir, I wanted to ask, interested in your thoughts regarding, we talked a little bit about the Revolution and Enlightenment. Do you see either or of those elements influencing Napoleon, or was he was one more influential than the other?
Yeah, I think I think both, and I also think they influence each other, mm-hmm. right? So as many books as there are on the Enlightenment, that's how many definitions there are. I would say that the Enlightenment is about the utility of knowledge, right? Because the Enlightenment's not the first time people thought. It's not the first time people use systematic reason. That's the way it's often described. Aquinas would argue against that. The Enlightenment is about the application of knowledge. It's the first time in human history, at least in Western Europe, where one person can't be expected to know most things, because we now have huge volumes of information coming in from printed sources and from exploration, colonization, imperialism, right? So for me, the quintessential Enlightenment thinker is Carl Linnaeus. He's about creating taxonomies, and the Enlightenment is about taxonomies, because that's how you apply reason. I have a mass of knowledge. How do I use my knowledge to make sense of it, right? It's about control. So Napoleon is a figure of the Enlightenment very much in that he's about control. Napoleon believed that a society ran best when it was subject to a kind of paternalistic control, right? And you see this all throughout his career, whether it's him trying to break the English through his continental system, whether it's him reorganizing the churches in conquered spaces, whether it's him trying to manage his own family, which he failed miserably at. He is an Enlightenment applier, if you will, in that he is applying reason to try to better control people and channel their energies in positive ways. We can fall into the trap of thinking the Enlightenment is about tearing down. It's about, you know, agro-atheists tearing down the institutional church. It's not. The Enlightenment is fundamentally optimistic. It's about the betterment of humanity. Now, the Revolution is about doing that quickly and at large scale, right? So the Enlightenment was making small changes. Let's find new medicines. Let's figure out how medicine works, those kinds of things. The Revolution comes along and says, hey, this hereditary nobility thing, it doesn't actually make sense. It's a kind of tyranny, to use Montesquieu's explanation, because it's against reason to have hereditary nobility. So we're going to tear that out by the roots. So the one feeds into the other. Napoleon is very much a figure of the Revolution, despite a lot of revolutionaries denying that, right? Napoleon was more conservative than the Revolution in many ways. So, for example, he spun back divorce from being a one-party agreement, if you will, to a mutual consent agreement, which, as you can imagine, hurt women a lot, because their husbands had to agree to a divorce. But outside of France, he was often far more liberal than the governments he was conquering. So within France, he's kind of a conservative, but everywhere else he's pretty liberal. So when he goes to the Habsburg lands, his restrictions he places on free speech are more liberal than the Habsburg restrictions on free speech, including in print. So he would see himself as a figure of the revolution. And a lot of people do see him that way, but a lot of people also don't. I would argue the way people see Napoleon says as much about their own politics as it does about Napoleon, which is not an improper way of looking at him, because he can be a mirror, too.
So rather than asking, who do you vote for, just ask, what do you think of Napoleon?
Pretty much.
Sir, one question, bringing it back to some of the discussions about the campaigns. Which, in your opinion, what campaign do you think most exemplifies the qualities that we associate with Napoleon? And are there campaigns that we don't associate well with Napoleon?
Yeah, I think the obvious one is all Austerlitz, right? So what Napoleon does in the time of peace, the only time of peace really between 1792 and 1814, in 1802, from 1802 to 1805, he crafts the Grande Armée. This is when he sets up the corps, this is when he makes the marshals, this is when he trains everybody. Imagine being at NTC, except NTC has six divisions instead of one, and you're there for 18 months. Imagine how skilled the army would be coming out of that, right? And cost is no objection. That's what he does when he's in the camp at Bologna on the North French coast. The idea is he's going to invade England, but he can't. He can't get across the channel. So instead, he unleashes that army. It swarms down the Rhine, onto the Danube, surrounds the Austrian commander, Mack, at Ulm. They surrender without a major battle. And then he flows back along the Danube, takes Vienna, goes north, defeats the combined Austro-Russian army at Austerlitz. And every piece of the Napoleonic formula is there, up to and including strategic victory on the battlefield, right? Because when he beats the coalition army at Austerlitz, the two main heads of state are on the battlefield. He doesn't have to send any diplomats because everybody's there, right? That's part of one of the secrets of Napoleon's formula. If your enemies are right there, the treaty's easy. The other one I would suggest, kind of the 1B, is the 1806 campaign, not for the fighting. There's a famous Dennis Showalter line where basically Napoleon messed up everything he possibly could have in the Jena-Auerstedt campaign. The reason we like that campaign, though, is the pursuit. After the battle, Napoleon again unleashes his corps, in particular Murat's cavalry, and they run down the Prussian army to the point where, if I remember the numbers correctly, at the beginning of that war, there are 250,000 Prussians in the Prussian army. By the end of the pursuit, there's 20,000 left. The rest of them have surrendered or been made casualties. And that small force is the one left in Königsberg. So for the pursuit, it is the example of operational-level pursuit. I'm not really aware of another one that took place after a battle like that. So not so much for the battle, but for the pursuit. But definitely the 1805 Ulm-Austerlitz campaign. And then the ones, there's plenty that don't show his formula, right? The Polotsk and Eylau campaigns in late 1806, early 1807, he's just kind of wandering around Poland. He gets a corps annihilated at Eylau. And then, of course, 1812, there's the great debate where they're at Borodino, the Russians are dug in, his marshals are saying, hey, their left flank is completely unexposed, let's go around. And Napoleon basically does a Robert Duval in Gettysburg and says, no, they're there, let's go attack them. And of course, a bunch of people die, and that's the beginning of the end for him. So I would say there's lots of negative ones, but 1805 is kind of the best of the apotheosis of Napoleon, if you will.
Got it, sir. Appreciate it.
Well, I had one kind of more big question on the Napoleon, the historical figure, then we'll get on to the film here in a second, is... We kind of touched on it a little bit already, but obviously we go from General Napoleon to Emperor Napoleon. You talked about how good he was at administration, but running a country and an empire at that is a lot. Mm-hmm. Running the most modern army Europe has ever seen at that time and place is a lot, and he's doing both at the same time. Mm-hmm. So do you think once he becomes Emperor Napoleon, it kind of starts to distract and kind of take away from some of that genius that you referred to earlier?
Yeah, I think so. There's a couple things that happen that greatly contribute to his downfall. One of them is the other side of the coin of the genius, right? There's a wonderful quote that I like to abuse that's probably from Marshal Bernadotte, who goes on to become King Carl the 14th Johan of Sweden. His descendants are still on the Swedish throne. And it's that Napoleon was defeated because he refused to give up, that he relied too much on his own genius until it got to the point where he couldn't do it anymore, right? So he traveled, when he was on campaign, he traveled with his military staff, but also his imperial household. So his government staff went with him too. Imagine if the White House and the Pentagon traveled with the president on campaign, right? So he had the ability to run his state from wherever he was. And to give you an example, both of his mania for control and how much attention he paid to detail, he had several traveling libraries. But he also had libraries at the palaces he lived in. And he demanded of his librarian that every library be stocked with the same books in the same place so that he could be in the morning at one palace reading a book, go to another palace later that day, pull the same book off the same shelf, and keep reading it. And he was a voracious reader. He was also famous when he didn't like a book. He'd throw it out of his carriage and tell his librarian to burn it. His mind works on so many different levels. I mean, he's the guy playing 4D chess. The problem is, the other side of the operational art coin is, yes, if you have these articulated corps fighting operational level warfare, when corps meets division, corps wins, right? When corps meets corps, they lock together. And it's really hard to win those kind of telescoping, tactical, up to strategic level victories. So this is the Bob Epstein thesis, and Epstein was actually on the faculty here at SAMS. What he argues is, as soon as the opponents of Napoleon, first the Austrians in 1809 and the rest of them, when they started developing core structures of their own, Napoleon could no longer win the tactical victory that then produced the operational and strategic victory. The armies just locked together. And once that happened, Napoleon's genius also declined at the same time, right? And I think it's fair to say his hubris also increased, right? He thought he could control Spain. He thought he could march into Russia and the Tsar would surrender again. So when you put those three things together, I think you see all of the seeds of his downfall. And as we all know, this is the problem of relying on the one person. You know, the one person is great until they're not.
Absolutely. So I want to kind of pivot from there, because that was a great discussion on the man and in some cases the myth of Napoleon. But it's almost that myth now that we're going to see personified on the big silver screen.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, have you seen the trailer for the
yes.
new movie?
All right. Yeah, I've seen Ridley Scott's Napoleon trailer.
What are your kind of initial thoughts on it?
Yeah, so I have to reserve judgment, unfortunately, unlike some of my colleagues who did a lot of dunking on it. The trailer is very short, and there's not much of what we military historians would want to see in it, right? There's not much battle. So I think we have to reserve judgment. I am willing to give Ridley Scott the benefit of the doubt. He does historical fiction very well. Now, understand, we're saying historical fiction. He's not making a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a Ken Burns slow pan across a photograph, right? But I think what I've seen, I'm excited by. I think he's got the vibe right, which is hard to do in history movies. I think, not to pick on her, but I think Shonda Rhimes often gets this wrong. And I'm saying this as a historian, right?
Yeah.
I think it's really easy to do what she does, which is project modern ideas back into the past. And I'm not making a political or social statement. I mean just the way that the product feels.
Mm-hmm.
So the trailer feels like the 1790s. And I think that's good. To use a positive analogy, if you're familiar with the show Versailles, which is a Franco-Italian product that's made in English, the history's awful. It's nothing in it is right, but it's got the vibes right. It feels like Louis XIV's Versailles. And the trailers of the Napoleon movie feels like 1790s Napoleon. Now, there's some questions about what we see in the trailer, right? So there's a shot of Napoleon with like seven people around him charging somewhere. And the joke one of my colleagues, Dr. Rick Schneid, made was, that's what happens in Total War when you charge with your headquarters units, right? So I don't know what's happening there. We need more context. The big thing for me is Joaquin Phoenix just looks too old. Napoleon is supposed to be a very young man at the beginning of his career. And he died. He died when he was, what, 51? So, you know, his public life ended before he was 45. So he should be a young and young looking person. Even at the end, he still kind of had a boyish look to him. So that's my main concern so far. It's just he does not look the part. But you can overcome that, right? In The Tudors, another great historical fiction series, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers looks nothing like Henry VIII.
Yeah.
But he acts like him, which is what matters, yeah. Right?
So we kind of touched on this at the very beginning in the first part of our discussion. But to kind of bring it back to the second part, what makes Napoleon good for cinema? Like, why him opposed to all the other famous men and women throughout history?
I think to do fiction, right? And again, we're not making documentaries, so we're talking fiction. You need drama. And there are few historical subjects as dramatic as the French. That's why I would argue Les Miserables is the only good musical, because it's the only subject melodramatic enough for a musical, right? French history. So you got the drama. You got the drama of the person. And one of the things that the bicentennial Franco-Italian Napoleon miniseries got right is there are many scenes where Napoleon goes into a meeting with his family and just looks exhausted, trying to herd all these cats who all have their own different ideas of the way things should be. And so he's got the personal drama in addition to kind of the historical and the cultural drama, right? So he's perfect for that in that way. He is also this great romantic figure. He's a romantic figure straight out of any fictional property. He embodies the age for good, for ill, or in between. He is as Hegel would make him, he is the Weltgeist. He is the embodiment of the progress of the period. He is driving people to change, whether they like it or not. And we like people like that. There's a reason we keep making movies and shows about Alexander and Caesar and people, you know, Washington, people who are the embodiment of their age and who are paragons in a way. Now, the danger with that is you turn them into a caricature. And I think that's a very fine line to walk, especially with kind of the modern deconstructionist view, where everybody has to have childhood trauma and, you know, deep-seated motives. I think it's hard to do history right in a fictional property, especially one that's going to be short. Right, like I kind of laughed when they said that Ridley Scott has a director's cut that's 4 hours long, as if that's too long. That's probably an order of magnitude too short to do Napoleon justice.
Well, I'll be sitting patiently for that one.
Yeah.
So we talked about some like the pinnacles and the low points of Napoleon's specifically military career in part one, but when it comes to seeing something, visualizing some of this stuff. Is there a moment in Napoleon's life that you are looking forward to, or you absolutely like, if I have to see one thing about Napoleon, I want to see this. I want to see Jan Ostad. I want to see Austerlitz. What would that be?
Yeah, so I think we do actually see a piece of that in the trailer when he's in Egypt, right? And I some of my friends and colleagues have some quibbles with that scene as it's presented in the trailer. But can you imagine being Napoleon, or better yet, being one of his soldiers? And whether or not he actually said it, saying something like 40 centuries look down upon you. You know, there's a weight of history to that that gives it a lot of meaning. And I think Kubrick nails this in Barry Lyndon, right? A lot of people hated Barry Lyndon because it's an empty movie.
which is the way the British look at the Rococo period. They see it as beautiful and artistic and empty. But what he does is he gives us the shot that's the painting. We have lots of amazing paintings of Napoleon, not the silly one of him on the horse in the Alps, right? But the painting of his coronation, mm-hmm. right? You have to do that in the movie, and you have to make it look like the painting, which is what Kubrick was so good at doing, right? He actually took the paintings and then filmed them as a scene. Comic book movies tend to be pretty good at this. So if you watch Zack Snyder's adaptations of comic books, he's very good at taking the comic as a template, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's Napoleon looking at the Sphinx or his coronation or any one of the battlefield paintings, what I want to see is those moments where Scott brings those prior interpretations of Napoleon into the story. And you were absolutely right earlier when you talked about myth. Another reason we like people like this is the myth wraps itself around them. And people like that, we are very much attracted to.
So I got one last question for you, and then I'll hand it over to Brian to kind of close it out. So normally we ask at the end of every podcast, recommend one book, but I'm going to isolate this to Napoleon today. If you could recommend one book, one video, one podcast on Napoleon, mm-hmm. what would it be and why?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. In part because there's not any one book that captures all of him, right? There is still not a standard single biography that does justice to him in a way that's not kind of turning him into a paragon, right? There's a famous book written in 1940 called Napoleon For and Against, and too often the book is either Napoleon For or Napoleon Against, right? So... if you're interested in the one-off, it's not a short book, but the one-off book about his wars, Alex Mikhaylovich's Napoleonic Wars is the newest, the most comprehensive, and the best look at the Napoleonic Wars as a holistic series of events, not just focused on what's happening in Europe, right? For beginners, Chandler's book on the Napoleonic Wars is still a good read for people who are not, PhD historians. There's a lot that's wrong with it, but it's fine as an intro book. Now, if I had to recommend one media property, it would be the Age of Napoleon podcast, which is an incredibly immersive, very much in-depth, probably I think he's got to be over 100 hours of content now, deep dive into Napoleon and his career, kind of focusing on the military side, but not limited to that. But that's the if you have lots and lots of free time recommendation.
Yeah, plenty of that here at Sam's. That's a joke for anybody out there. All right, Brian, you got anything else?
Sir, some of the questions that we typically like to ask, and we've talked about it a little bit, is the operational level of war, operational art, and we really just in general wanted to get your thoughts on both. History, what are your thoughts, its application, both operational art and the operational level of war, sir?
Yeah, so I've kind of been struggling with this over the last couple months as we get into the meat of our kind of Western Europe block at CGSC, and understand this is kind of an evolving position. But what I study is, ironically, I don't really study Napoleon. I study the 18th century French army, and I study military theory. And what I would say is, and what I say to students is, the operational level of war is really obvious and important in a Napoleonic campaign, right? And Jomini lays this out really well. If you combine his grand tactics and logistics layer into operations, his strategy level is the armies are in depot. The planning is being done to figure out what their task and purpose is. The tactics level, he calls it, it's translated as minor tactics. It should be translated petty tactics. A regiment should always fight the same. So that's the battlefield. The space between them is operations. The operational level is, in a Napoleonic context, how you get from the depot to the battlefield. Now, the problem with that is modern warfare doesn't do that anymore. It certainly doesn't do it as neatly as Napoleonic armies did, where you go from depot to assembly point to marching across the countryside to massing for a battle.
Now we have preposition forces. We have a range of military capabilities, including space and cyber, right? And we don't march from depot to battlefield anymore. More to the point, if you look at large-scale combat operations over the last, 130 years, it's not single field armies marching against single field armies. So if we take the example of 1915 on the Western Front in Europe, you've got, if I'm remembering correctly, three German army groups, seven German field armies, shoulder to shoulder, channel to Switzerland. There's no operational level of war there. It's just a series of tactical engagements that may or may not be connected to each other as they try to punch through these lines. Now, the problem, of course, is you are missing the penetrating effects of air and armor, right? So it's possible to envision it returning in World War II. But even then, I would argue that what the Soviets are doing in say, Operation Bagration, where they bite a huge chunk out of the German army, I think they take out an entire army group, they inflict something like 450,000 casualties, it doesn't look like Napoleonic operational warfare. It may be operational warfare, the Soviets certainly would say it is, but it's not the march from depot to battlefield. So I think the difficulty for modern warfare, and notice we haven't touched insurgency, right? Mm-hmm. I tend to be with Jomini in saying I acknowledge it exists, but I'd rather talk about conventional war. The challenge for the modern practitioner is to define the operational level of war, because we no longer have a single definition of it, right? So to follow Jomini's lead, we must first apply the Enlightenment process of building a heuristic. What kind of conflict are we in? What are its characteristics? What is the operational level of war in this conflict? If you are fighting battalion tactical groups invading a country next to you, do you have an operational level of war, or are you just fighting disconnected tactics? I think we might agree in 50 years, when historians get a hold of the Russo-Ukraine war, that that was maybe not operationally focused, right? I don't know, because our successors will figure that out. But I think that's the challenge. It's to not make the operational level the end, but the beginning. And I think we too often do this with theory, with heuristics, with doctrine, right? That stuff it's the beginning of understanding. It's the input that Napoleon's staff fed him that it's our job to understand what it means and how it applies to the conflict we're looking at it, that we're looking at. I think Mao says something very important when he says, essentially, there's no universal doctrine. You must figure out the conflict you're in and then figure out how to act within that space, right? China's Revolutionary War. So I think for the operational level of war and for the operational art, it's to take the input and then decide what to do with it, but not get wrapped up in parsing the minute details of the operational level or any level.
That's very interesting, sir. That's an interesting way to look at it, something I had not considered previously. And transitioning from that, a second question we like to ask. We asked about Napoleon recommendations. Sir, is there anything that you're reading now that you would like to recommend for us that maybe, I don't assume that you're reading about Napoleon all the time, so is there anything else that you, or what you're reading now that you'd like to mention here for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that people can read to understand warfare and maybe the near and future aspects of it. I have been a fan since grad school of Pete Singer's work. Mm-hmm. What I think he does is really important in that he looks to the actual future. I think we have a bad habit of talking about the present and saying it's the future, right? What Singer says is that we need to look to science fiction. Mm. And in particular, I'm drawing from his book, Wired for War, which is now, I mean, it's approaching 20 years old. So the details of it are not, he talks a lot about drone warfare that we far surpassed. Mm-hmm. But the principles are good. we don't need to be looking at technology to figure out what future warfare is. We need to be watching sci-fi shows and reading sci-fi books, right? So I'll give you a good example. To a lot of people, drone warfare is the future. Drone warfare is the present, but it's also the past, right? We've been using drones in war for 20 years. Mm-hmm. That's not the future. The future is cybernetic warfare. So one of the big problems technology has now is batteries, right? We're running around the world trying to find all the lithium. We have an inexhaustible battery that you only need to feed calories in our body. Somebody's going to start marrying the technology with the biological battery. And Singer talks about this in Wired for War. So what does that mean? What does that mean for warfare? What does it mean when you have soldiers who have a HUD implanted in their brain that can be accessed by their commander? What happens when you give them an exoskeleton that that HUD can control, right? When you're only using them as a battery, what does that mean for our rules of engagement? What would that mean for rules of engagement to have a robot army fight a human army? Does that change how we approach fighting? Those are questions of warfare in the future. Another example, the Space Force. The Space Force currently largely looks down. It's a high air force, right? But at some point, somebody's going to capture an asteroid and use it as a weapon. Mm-hmm. I love the show The Expanse. I think everybody should watch The Expanse.
Agree.
They capture asteroids and use them as weapons. That's Space Force, right? When we have a war academy on Mars, we'll have a true Space Force. And we're headed that direction, of course, but that's something that's going to happen in centuries, not in years, right? So I think if I recommended any one thing, it's to follow Pete Singer's work, because he's one of these thinkers who just, he's, you know, one of the definitions of genius is people who can see connections that other people can't. Mm-hmm. And I think he can, and I think he's very good at it. He's working in the tradition of Ray Kurzweil, who's kind of his mentor. But if I had to recommend one thing, it's to read Singer and do what Singer says. You know, watch sci-fi.
Sir, along that note, any podcasts that you would recommend? Besides your own, of course.
I have to recommend my own, A Confused Heap of Facts. It is one of the few history-focused podcasts where PhD historians talk to other PhD historians. There's a lot of good podcasts in kind of the history space. One of the things that we have discovered as we've spent years arguing over what our history should be and how it should be taught is we all like history. We just kind of disagree on what it should be. So there's a lot of really good history, whether it's the more, you know, something as simple as like the YouTube oversimplified videos. Mm-hmm. Those are very, like, they aim very low. They're not designed to be particularly nuanced, but that doesn't mean they're bad history. They're very good history in most cases. All the way to the kind of the Dan Carlin, super immersive, you're going to spend hours listening to this podcast kind of property. So what I would say to people is just explore. If you're looking for history podcasts, find one that appeals to you. And check out their bona fides, make sure, you know, they're not crazy. But instead of recommending any one, you know, I did recommend the Age of Napoleon podcast, but instead of recommending any one, I would say, you know, it's a menu. Pull up your podcast app, go to the history genre, and just find ones that appeal to you. And as long as you're intaking history, that's fine with me.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you very much for your time, sir. Truly appreciate it.
I would say we started with Caesar and we finished with cybernetics. So I think this has been a pretty inclusive podcast today. Dr. Abel, thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on here. I'm excited for the movie. I hope you are too. And I hope to see you around, Sam's. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, glad sir. To be here. Thanks for having me.
The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by checking us out on Twitter at US_SAMS, Instagram at US.SAMS, and on LinkedIn. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or wish to engage with us, please email us at operationalarch@gmail.com.